Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Moon, Moo, and You, the Collective Wisdom. My name is Kate Loving-Shank, and Joan Adams and I host the show. The call-in number is 347-205-9200. Our special guest this evening is D.D. Delaney, who visits us four times a year at the time of the change of seasonal celebrations. We are celebrating the solstice this evening with D.D.'s play, The Lunar Project, Act One, called The Dog Star. Joining me now is Joan Adams. Hello, dear Joan.
Hello, dear Kate. How are you?
I am wonderful, and I am looking forward to listening and, you know, just absorbing the play that we're about to listen to.
That's what I'm thinking. I'm excited about this. I just want to relax and enjoy. It's always...
Yeah.
Always an experience to have D.D. on the show.
Yes.
Really is.
Probably an experiment too, Joan.
Probably.
Okay.
For us, it's always an experiment.
Yeah, that's true. Hi, Delaney.
Hi.
You say
How
Delaney,
you?
You don't say D.D. You
that's
just
right.
You
yeah.
call him Delaney. Okay.
Yeah.
Hey, Delaney.
Hi. Hi, Joan. Many people call me D.D., though.
Do they? Good.
Yeah.
I wasn't
so,
off
you
base
know,
there.
It all works.
It all works. My grandmother used to say, call me anything as long as it's not a bad word, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Well,
we're looking
so
forward
you're
to
here.
Your performance. Yes, thank you for joining us this evening.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. I'm looking forward to it, too.
Do we just want to go right ahead, or do you have a few words to say as a way of introduction?
Well, no, I don't think so. I think I would just as soon begin. And
okay.
Let the story speak for itself. We can talk later about, you know, anything that you might want to ask, or maybe I'll have some observations later.
Wonderful.
And can you hear me all right?
Yeah, you really sound very clear.
That's
yes,
good. That's good. Okay. So shall I begin?
Yes.
This is The Dog Star, Act One of The Lunar Project. A one-person play, stage tale, written by me, D.D. Delaney. In the last months of 1973, before our commune fell, I received two prophetic signs. If I'd recognized them at the time, which I didn't, I would have understood that my real life was far from over, my true goals only clarified when all that I clung to so hopelessly, my home, my way of life, and most of my friends, my closest comrades, were finally lost. By then, no doubt to compensate for our group insecurity, we were all sleeping in heaven. That was the name we'd optimistically given to the upstairs room of virtually wall-to-wall mattresses above the kitchen under the low-peaked roof. In the 2.5 years of our commune's existence, we'd shared many intimacies and many griefs up in heaven. At night, we kept a red darkroom bulb lit so people could find their way back and forth to bed. Someone was always awake and prowling around. Sometimes, in the deep of the night, in that red light, when something would wake me, my normal perceptions would not immediately engage. There would be this slippery gap of time. time and space between sleeping and waking, a delay of recognition as my familiar surroundings emerged, like a photograph in developing fluid. And in that gap sometimes, well, strange things happened. One night, I was interrupted from sleep by a caress, soft, warm, and moist, deliberate, a kiss, in fact, sweet, tenderly brushing my lips and nose. I opened my eyes in surprise. A dark-skinned, sylph-like creature, not 2 feet tall, almost shadow-like behind a brown veil billowing off her back, glided away as she glanced at me over her shoulder. She wore a golden half-mask that highlighted black, almond, oval eyes glistening with affection. My heart swelled with a powerful love for her. As I pulled myself up on my elbow, I wanted to reach out for her, call her back. She looked away and waddled on out of the room. Only then did I realize that it was Marilyn, our little German Shepherd Beagle mix. A dear heart, to be sure, once you got to know her, but few could claim that privilege. She never allowed herself to be tamed. What had put it into her mind to kiss me like that in my sleep? And who was that Eastern lover, that exotic dancer who first appeared to my dream-soaked eyes? Could it have been Marilyn's unveiled soul, her true self? Well, no matter. I felt as if I'd been blessed by the entire natural world in that kiss. I fell back to sleep with a smile, savoring the depths of tenderness she'd stirred in me. And guess what? That was the first sign. I didn't know it at the time. I didn't understand it for many years, but not long after, Marilyn disappeared. We believed one of our former members, in an act of passion coldly calculated, had kidnapped her and had her killed, but we were never certain. In another few years, suburban developers were making plans for a shopping center on what had once been the wooded acres behind the commune property. By that time, of course, it was no longer a commune, but a private family residence. The natural spirit had left. When I realized that, I also realized that I could probably pinpoint just about precisely when that had happened. Not long after Marilyn's disappearance, in the middle of another night, just a few weeks before the end, something again woke me up. I was lying on my back. In the dim, red-lit glow spread across the low-sloped ceiling, there was a man standing at the foot of my mattress, watching me. I had the feeling he'd been there for a while. He wore an overcoat or cloak, but no hat or hood, and I could see his face clearly, a friendly face, a lean, weathered, strong-featured face with thick, bushy hair and deep, humorous eyes. For a moment, I gazed up at him in utter peace and trust, not at all surprised, like a child waking up to see my father, back home late from business, come into my room to say goodnight and smiling down on me with great kindness, great benevolent reassurance. But though I instinctively trusted and I think loved this man, it began to dawn on my waking consciousness that I didn't know him. Who was he? What was he doing in here? I squinted for focus, but familiar as he seemed, I just couldn't place him. Curiosity began to rouse me. I lifted my head, peering at him. I pulled myself up on my elbow. In an instant, half his energy banks blinked off. It was as if someone threw a switch. He still smiled at me, but he was only half as vivid. At the same time, I realized, he was disembodied. Only a face. He was in a circle of red light. It almost seemed as if he beamed himself in from someplace outside, above the roof. My curiosity became fascination. It was no longer a question of who he was. What was he? I sat up, open-mouthed, entranced, probing hard for some clue to his identity. He dimmed again, another blink down of intensity fading him considerably. Now I became aware of the surface of the ceiling behind him and of the other sleepers in the room. And then, still smiling, he vanished. Poof! Gone. I stared at the spot in the ceiling where moments before there'd been a three-dimensional presence projected over my head. And that was the second sign. After that, the commune fell, and we all scattered in different directions and began separate individual lives. In that transition, which was traumatic, I often thought of those apparitions who had appeared to me in heaven during those final nights. And I've thought about them often since. Marilyn, the Eastern lover disguised in a small dog's body, hadn't taken our separation seriously in the least. She just wanted to say, au revoir, don't worry, I love you. She wasn't the only dog over the years, up to then or since, who'd come to tell me goodbye. But she was the most theatrical, and her enchanting farewell dancing kiss, certainly the most provocative. It took me a long time to understand this disregard for tragedy, this nonchalant coming and going that all these animals seem to play with life and thoroughly enjoy. And as for the smiling gentleman in the ceiling, well, I think he came to wake me up and to show me an escape route as he disappeared as if into ever deeper layers of an onion, saying, come on, this way, follow me. For a time after the commune fell and my balance in life seemed irretrievable, I feared he'd been a demon or a heathen nature spirit, a fatal omen, but no, always his benevolence belied that interpretation. Now, he was something else, from somewhere else, from another dimension, invisible to my normal eyes, yet not unfamiliar at all. And I think he challenged me to a game of hide-and-seek. I didn't know how to play or if I should, and I spent a lot of time worrying about that. But I always knew, for better or for worse, that I couldn't resist. In the meantime, after 8 months of great instability, I finally landed as a part-time janitor in a psychiatric daycare center, one of those new outpatient facilities springing up at the time to treat the influx of clients returning to their communities from the state hospitals the government was closing down. It struck me as a perfect synchronous coincidence that I landed there. But aren't they all? For I believed, if my employers only knew, that I was but one fragile part-time job away from being a client in that center myself. I'd been working at the psychiatric center about 6 months. Because I was educated and wrote articles each week for the local independent press, the psychiatric staff befriended me as something of an interesting character. In fact, they indulged me liberally and invited me to their frequent parties. Many of them were heavy drinkers, but they stayed away from the psychedelics, which was fine with me. I could drink all night in those days, but I had a morbid fear of being even in the same room with psychedelics. I'd had to give them up after the commune fell. Humiliating admission. Up to then, I'd been evangelistically committed to them. I considered them invaluable, liberating my social persona and illuminating my plodding lower mind. It was much to my chagrin when I realized that in this so-called real world where I'd become transplanted, psychedelics decimated me, I sensed ambition and self-interest prioritized just about everywhere I went. If I dared get stoned around these worldly people, my natural discomfort with competition and conflict became magnified to schizophrenic proportions. I never knew what to say or how to act to validate myself in their eyes. And in my vulnerability, I felt eaten alive by them. My official hours at the psychiatric center were Monday through Friday from 4 to 8 p.m. In reality, no one cared when I got there or how long I stayed, just so long as I got the work done. However, there was one particular day, a windy, chilly fall afternoon, as it turned out, when I'd been asked to be on time. Well, unfortunately, I was running late that day when I set out from my apartment, walking across town to work since I had no car, not even a bicycle then. By the time I got downtown, it was already 4:30. I was worried that I was late, but I was also hungry. I'd missed lunch. I still ate hot dogs in those days, so I stopped in for one at Woolworth's before continuing to the psychiatric center. Well, that way, I told myself, I'd be set. I could get down to work as soon as I arrived. I considered ordering the hot dog to take out and eating it as I walked, but instead, I decided to stay inside, out of the wind where it was warm. I packed my roll with sauerkraut and onions, topped it with a fat dollop of mustard, and sat down at one of the tables by the front plate glass window of the store. Just outside my window, on the street, the day-end crowds gathered, waiting for their buses home. They all seemed economically disadvantaged. Many were physically infirm. Among them, I recognized several clients from the psychiatric center. Other people, with nowhere else to go, sat on the benches, blending in. I guess I became fascinated by these poor, these indigent, these mentally and physically disrepaired who jostled and jested with each other right next to my table, really, except for the protective barrier of a plate glass window between us. I began to imagine I'd seen them all somewhere before, in other cities, centuries removed. I imagined them congregating on the streets of 19th century Paris, 17th century Rome, 1st century Athens. Possibly I dozed off and was dreaming. In any case, I came back to my senses with a start. My half-eaten hot dog was stone cold, while outside the street was dark and deserted. I couldn't believe I lost track of time like that. I bolted down the rest of my hot dog and quickly left Woolworth's. Half running, I strode the remaining blocks to work, only hoping that everyone would be gone from the psychiatric center by that time. So it was not at all to my liking when, as I came up the block, I saw light streaming out of every window of the building's three tall stories. Professional people passed in and out through the front doors in a steady exchange. I felt slightly betrayed. No one had told me there was going to be a function tonight. But most of all, I felt painfully conspicuous about arriving so late. I pulled open the front door, stepped into the foyer, sprang up the three short steps to the landing. Oh, people holding plastic cups of wine stood in the hallway outside the front office and at the bottom of the second floor stairs. Beyond them were more people in the community room where by day the clients socialized. Chatter lilted and droned from everywhere, pierced by trills of laughter ringing generously in many keys. I didn't see anyone I recognized, which suited me at that moment, nor did anyone relate to me. Anonymously, I made my way through the guests toward the stairs. But then, too late, I saw Dawn, the part-time undergraduate trainee, standing just inside the double doorways of the community room, looking right at me. Then she looked away, had she deliberately ignored me? Oh, I began to think I might be in trouble. The wooden stairs were wide like an old school's and creaked like ship's timbers in the up-and-down flow of people treading them. I joined the right-sided flow climbing upstairs. Another flow returned downstairs on the left. I still didn't know anyone until I saw Gail, the occupational therapist, on the steps above me coming down. But she didn't smile back when she saw me. She looked the other way. And when we passed each other, our shoulders barely a foot apart, she said to the person in front of her on the stairs, "Ew, do you smell onions?" Gail had been among the most friendly to me of all the staff. I knew I was in trouble if she actually meant to put me down like that. Upstairs in the lounge, outside the group therapy room, I saw Carolyn, the director of the center, the one who hired me, standing among a group of men in gray suits. She did not ignore me, but stared at me coldly for several interminable seconds before she resumed her conversation. So, that was that. Obviously, I'd blown it. Later, no doubt, I'd find out how badly. I just hoped that I'd only be reprimanded, not fired. Well, for the moment, I could think of nothing else to do but go get my broom out of the closet and begin sweeping the halls. But people continued to come and go at a steady rate, interrupting me consistently. Oh, patiently, I'd step aside. It was my own fault. I knew that. I should have been in and out of here long before these people ever arrived. But I did not want to stop sweeping. My broom, my good, sturdy, nearly new, stiff straw broom, was my security. It stood between me and the indignity of dependence on charity and welfare. It identified me, telling these people that I had a function here, in fact, a job. Nita, the psychiatric nurse, came into the hall through a doorway near where I stood, waiting for some passersby before I resumed sweeping. By coincidence, she was my astrological twin, born the same day, same year as I. She looked like an ex-nun in her long-sleeved, high-collared white blouse and black skirt falling below her knees. For a moment, I thought she intended to ignore me, too, as she glanced at me, then looked away. But no. No, she turned back toward me and came toward me, catching my attention with a purposeful summons in her wide, dark eyes. I waited. She stopped by my shoulder and said, almost suggestively, close to my ear, "Have you ever been to a party at Funky Farm?" Oh, ho, ho, ho. Had I ever been to one? Funky Farm was our commune. I helped throw those famous parties that people still talk about to this day. To Nita, I said, "No. Why? Want to?" "Well, what do you mean?" Well, I thought she might be trying to bait me in some way. Well, I well knew that Funky Farm and its legendary parties were over. There's one tonight. Right now. Come on. It's a blast, man. You can do anything you want to there.
Really?
She touched my arm with invitation. Give yourself a break. Come on. And with a playful tilt of her head toward the end of the hall, she began walking away from me. I hesitated. What could she mean? She stopped, waited, her eyes teasing me.
Well, was I coming or wasn't I? What the hell? I went.
We left the building down the back fire escape unnoticed and got away in her canary Mustang. She promised she'd cover for me with the bosses, which seemed helpful all around, and I, well, I didn't promise anything. I was only along for the ride, and if there was a party at the end of it, fine. But it couldn't be at Funky Farm. Funky Farm didn't exist anymore. We were on our way out of the city, heading west toward the rugged river country, when Nita burst out laughing like a giddy crow. Ha ha! You fool! You brought your broom! So I had. I'd wedged it in with me on the diagonal between my seat and the car door. It had just fit. Nita was a fast driver. I remembered now. I'd been warned. Now I watched as her headlights reamed the darkness, racing after the narrow winding road up and down the country hills like a cartoon car chase. Trees and farmhouses and bony corn stalks ripe for reaping flashed out of the dark by my window and back into oblivion again like ghosts, like subconscious memories momentarily fluttered then forgotten. You do drive fast, I said. I'm a maniac. Put on your seatbelt. I don't like to wear seatbelts. We are twins. I wouldn't be caught dead in one. Ha ha! How do you know about Funky Farm? I blurted out. But she answered me only with a grin, all the more enigmatic for its broad enjoyment. Still, I was sure I'd never mentioned it to her. I kept my immediate past obscure from my new acquaintances. They could only guess at where I'd been during the last fateful years of the Vietnam War and all that went with it. Mostly, in my estimation, they had no idea. Well, the next I knew, we were there, lurching down the bumpy gravel road to the hollow below, where the miniature 100-year-old farmhouse sat at the center of a circle of trees. Incredibly, there were scores of people about, standing in the yards, sitting on the porches, stuffed into the little house upstairs and down. It was as if the place had never stopped partying. Loud talk and laughter filled the hollow with populist festival. It made me grin again. The night had turned warm. People were in T-shirts and some wore shorts. I left my own jacket and shoes in the car, I guess, because I arrived on the porch outside the kitchen barefoot in just my T-shirt and jeans. I almost expected to rejoin there with my former self, hilarious around the beer keg in the yellow porch light above the kitchen door. But, of course, myself was not there until I arrived, beginning to find it odd that while all these people were familiar types, I didn't recognize any individuals, nor did any of them relate to me. It was almost as if I were invisible to them. Well, not that they looked through me exactly, they just didn't relate to my presence. Well, not much had changed, it seemed, from the psychiatric center I'd just escaped. I felt just as isolated here as I had there, as if I operated in a dimension askew from the others. I wished for one of the dogs to show up and recognize me, but there didn't seem to be any dogs around. None. And as for Nita, I didn't know what had become of her. We'd gotten separated as soon as we'd climbed out of the car. Well, luckily, I still had my broom, a simple, tangible symbol to hold on to. I thought I may as well sweep the porch. It needed it. Littered as it was with clots of mud, bits of leaves and straw, and splinters of kindling wood. Yeah, well, sweeping wasn't very exciting, but it was safe, and I proceeded with rare thoroughness, making the task last as long as I could. The lights from the party, from the porch, spilled out over the convivial partiers, who stumbled over the irregular patio I'd built barehanded, with rocks we'd hauled up from the river several years ago now. Music played on the stereo inside. Sweet, drunken, lovelorn guitars weeping on the back of a relentless driving drum. I stopped sweeping for a moment and looked out over the scene with a touch of nostalgia. I'd lived here, a place like no other, for 2 winters and 3 summers. I could follow the paths through the woods in the dark, barefoot. I knew hidden hollows and groves few people had ever seen. I could find green growing food and medicinal antidotes most people would think were weeds. I'd even met some of the spirits who drifted up from the river in the fall mists, delighted if given half a chance to scare the wits out of inexperienced minds. But those were the sacred memories. They may have meant the most to me, but I could not communicate them or make them meaningful to society at large. There was no interest. They had value only in my own soul. The other memories, far less congenial, were more appealing to the public. The police organized massacre of our dogs. The con men and armed paranoids who dropped by with warrants out on them. The alcoholism and addiction spreading among us like an infectious disease. And a terrible, haunting misunderstanding that grew up among us like a cancer-causing radiation, polluting us little by little, one day at a time, seeping into our lives from some seminal, little understood, unhappy event that no one could exactly identify, except that it caused us all to become angry and dissatisfied increasingly, and to blame our troubles on one another. Because of these unpleasant memories, which still on occasion filled me with a feeling of infinite pain, I was grievously sad, but never sorry, when the commune finally fell. Well, I knew it had fallen. What was I doing now, back here on this porch, the timeless and familiar scene of country revelry unfolding again in full sight and sound right before my eyes? I felt like a ghost bound to a place where I died. Why didn't anyone know me? Where were the other funks, as we called ourselves, who shared it with me? What had happened to Nita? But a moment later, I forgot all these questions in a single, awe-filled instant. I happened to look up. The moon, the equinox harvest moon, dripped her milky dew through the half-bare branches of the front yard's reigning maple tree, mesmerizing me. I left the porch as if in a trance, heading down into a lower yard for a better view of the sky. I passed the boxwoods at the top of the steps, ran my fingers through their hair the way I used to. I felt the cool dew of the grass wiping my feet clean. There was the popcorn tree. She was a young dogwood, but in the spring her blossoms burst from their buds like white clusters of popcorn covering her up and down. Now she wore her fall gown of burgundy and crimson, a princess standing in the moonlight. I looked up. Oh, it took my breath away. Never had I seen the moon more beautiful or more vivid. A creamy, softly polished disc of radiance, a transfixing, infinitely gentle blessing over this balmy Indian summer night. And at that moment, for some reason, I remembered what Nita had said to me earlier at the psychiatric center. You can do anything you want to there, she'd said. Oh, I'd half heard her at the time. Jaded, no doubt, by my own disillusionment. To most people, that meant permission to act out any fantasy they pleased. Let the buyer beware. We funks had seen a monotonously ruinous variety of fantasies during our tenure of open house. Many of them had been our own. It had never seemed to occur to anyone to try something original, something unique. Well, it never had to me. But now it did. To do anything I want at this party, I thought, do I have to get wild and drunk, take drugs, boogie like a savage, hustle women? I'd done all that over and over. Maybe there was something else. It was ticking inside of me, I don't mean a bomb, yet it was a little like that too. But more exactly, I mean an idea that I had not yet thought had begun jumping across the synapses of my subconscious brain, picking its way toward consciousness. Could it have come from the moon herself? Well, that sounds crazy, but I have no better explanation for what I thought to do next. I still had my broom. I wonder, I thought, if I could make the bristles of my broom catch fire from the moon's rays. It was only meant to be an experiment. No one was looking. Besides, what did that matter? I could do anything I wanted to here. Holding my broom like a fishing pole, I raised it, bristles up, toward the face of the moon. Sighting the broom into the moonlight, I concentrated on heating up the bristles in the subtle, imperceptible fire of moon rays. Later, I had to admit, it was a preposterous scheme. No one in the world I'd ever heard of thought the moon had a fire of her own. Scientists, philosophers, metaphysicians, even psychiatrists dismissed the very notion. Only one of the several therapists I spoke to afterwards would even risk a professional opinion. He suggested that I had an unconscious desire to quit my job. Now, he may have been right about that, but it couldn't have been all of it. It could only have been a fraction of it. In any case, I had not been long at my experiment when a jarring, intrusive roar rent the seamless peace of the night sky. It was a helicopter. In those days, I still had an animal fear of helicopters. The police had used them to catch us cultivating our remote marijuana patches or skinny dipping in isolated waters across America's park system. Now they were back. Here it came, descending through the treetops on my right, a startlingly large, strikingly dull gray vehicle with searchlights that lit up the whole lower yard like day. It crossed the path of my concentration between broom and moon and hovered over me slightly off to my left. The roar of the engines deafened me while the propeller blades whipped the cold wind down on me that stripped the leaves out of the trees like a November storm. Through the windows of the cockpit, I could see two scowling police officers stretching forward in their seats, scrutinizing the scene, and I thought me especially, as if they smelled a cesspool violation. Somehow, in this harsh disruption, I kept the thread of my concentration still attached to my experiment between broom and moon, and I grabbed hold of that thread now. Damn it, I told myself, I am not doing anything illegal. They have no authority over me in this. With all my will against the disintegration whirling down at me, I set my mind hard on that space between the moon and the straw-bristled tip of my common household broom, which I clung to now like a lifeline. Abruptly, the helicopter pulled out. It flew away. Night's gentle darkness enfolded me once more. The noises of the party resumed in my ears. The resistance was gone. And now the moon herself began to intensify. A rainbow aura emerged around her, casting a glow of fecund colors out through the mists of half the sky. I felt a surge of unimpeded power. An unobstructed channel opened like a long-awaited opportunity, and I thrust my concentration into it with the full, focused force of my purpose. What happened next astounded even me. All I can say is I was wide awake and sober as a fundamentalist. But as I concentrated with unwavering attention on the end of my broom, slowly, almost imperceptibly at first, but then more and more clearly, the broom's bristles began to take on a moon glow. Not daring to breathe lest I disturb it, I held my focus, and the glow increased. Languidly, lazily, the bristles began to undulate, then ease, slide, gradually melt together, fusing themselves into a molten ball-like mass, which torpidly turned in on itself and slowly began to revolve on the broom end. And as I continued to concentrate, not blinking, not breathing, that centripetal fusion, I realized, had begun to spin. To spin, without a doubt, with ever-increasing velocity, until, in fact, it spun so forcefully, so rapidly, that I could hardly hold onto the broom handle anymore. I expected the next moment to have it implode in my hands. Instead, the whirling ball snapped off the broomstick and shot skyward. An incandescent nugget, an iridescent fiery globe soaring into space. Stunned, with dropped jaw, I watched it climb, accelerating to an incalculable velocity. It passed to the right of the moon and kept going farther and farther until it was a speck, a pinpoint of celestial dust about to vanish forever. And then it stopped at the far reaches of the visible universe. It came to rest, as if in a magnetic field perfectly attuned to it, waiting for it, you could even say, drawing it there, all the way from the end of my broom. It had become a star. And no sooner had it locked into place than all around it, other stars fell, 10 or 15 of them streaking down the sky like fireworks on Independence Day. The hair stood up on my head. I howled like an animal from the abyss, an involuntary reflex of raw, primitive emotion. My body folded up like its strings had been cut. I collapsed on the ground like a fresh corpse. The partiers around the porch and on the hill above me all turned to look at me. I lay on the grass, helpless and profoundly shaken. Had I gone too far? Like a blundering fool, had I unbalanced the heavens? But then came a helping hand. A friendly, familiar face, the first since I'd gotten separated from Nita. It was Stella Vanella, who'd also lived here right up to the end. We'd found each other again. She'd pushed through the curious crowd and run down the hill to me, crouching now under my arms, steadying my weight on her shoulders as she helped me up. I was in a daze, but I still had hold of my broomstick. My eye happened to fall on its end where the bristles had been. To my shock, I saw the fire had sculpted it into the head of a dog, charred black and still smoking. At once, I recognized the familiar likeness of the leader of our pack, a favorite companion of my life, Marilyn's father, who a neighbor, in complicity with local police, had shot to death, breaking my heart. His open jaws pointed toward the sky, frozen in that moment of outcry, that howl, that roar of animal force, his and mine, at the shock and the trauma, at the mortal triumph of birthing a star. I turned to Stella. Our eyes met, similar mirrors to one another of common spiritual origins. What happened to you? You're scorched. I made a star. Far out! Did you see it? Well, I saw you shout something and fall down on the ground. I didn't try to. I just did it. In spite of everything, it just came spinning out. You can let it all hang out here, brother, she said, tightening me in her strong, sinewy grip. I know. That's why it happened. Look, I pointed with my new dog-headed staff, still smoking. To the right of the moon, the faint one farthest out. Can you see it? I think I can. But a transcendent recognition had begun to dawn on me. I felt filled with excitement. It's my guiding light. It's the star of my soul. I turned to her. I must have looked like a madman, a fanatic, but I could disguise myself no longer. I got it from the moon, a star, a sun, from the fire of the moon. Don't you see? I gripped her urgently. We were right, Stella. The opposite of what anyone would think is where it's at. But then we were interrupted by partiers surrounding us. They'd begun drifting down the hill, figuring it was okay now to check us out. And I? I did not have the opportunity to speak fully or freely of this again for a very long time.
The end.
Wow is right. That's awesome. The thing about you is when you start one of these tales, I get so lost in it, you know. I have my own little vision of what's going on.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, super.
I always thought that they would make a great animated film.
Yeah, it would.
Yeah. But that's like a dream. maybe it wouldn't. Maybe it's best to leave it the way it is.
Well, this is a dream, isn't it? Wasn't it?
Yes. It was partly a dream. It was a combination of a dream and real events. And it was based on my idea at the time, which I think I still believe in, that dreams are just as real as waking life. They just happen somewhere else.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the two can be knit together if you can interpret them correctly.
Mm-hmm.
So the piece, in a way, is a kind of dream interpretation in which, you know, I take parts of my waking life and try to hook it up in a meaningful or at least a narrative way with the dream events. There are actually a couple dreams woven into it, but the main part of the dream, which is the main part of the story, was it was a real dream. In fact, it was a lucid dream.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there, you know, they even strike me as more reliable or real or whatever than an ordinary dream where you don't know you're dreaming.
Yeah, I always feel like those are the ones you're supposed to really pay attention to.
Right. So my theory was that if I turned it into a story and memorized it and repeated it over and over again to myself, I would remember it.
Yeah.
And that's what I thought I'd do. And then I thought, well, maybe other people would enjoy this. And, many people do. I wouldn't say everybody, but many people do.
Yeah, I certainly, I enjoyed it. I love the dogs, you know,
The dog in the night.
Yeah. That her spirit came, you know, that whole, I love that. Yeah.
Yeah.
You would love that dog.
Oh, I can well imagine.
Yeah.
She was a beautiful dog, and we called her Marilyn Monroe, but not really. We called her Marilyn Monhan because she'd go, heh. And Yuli does that too, which
is right?
Hysterical.
Yeah, that's funny.
Maybe she came back.
Yeah. Well, you know, they all seem to be. The more that you have these dogs over years, they come and go into each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. It's hard to say which dog is which after a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and especially in our case, where we go golden retriever poodle and then replace them with golden retriever poodle. I mean, it's like...
Oh, it's like the same dog.
The same... Well, we always keep two dogs. We always have two dogs.
Uh-huh.
Well, we've always had a golden and a poodle.
Uh-huh.
And they do start to become the same.
Yeah.
Really do.
Well, we just got a dog. We hadn't had one for a couple of years. The last one was really traumatic. I mean, she was difficult, and then she had a terrible death with kidney failure. And we just we couldn't bring ourselves. We thought we were not going to get another dog unless it actually comes to the door. Well, sure enough, this, a couple of months ago, this this boxer came to the door. The people brought him, brought her, but she did literally come to our door, and we adopted her, and she's here right now, wondering why we moved her food bowl while I did this this show.
That was.
She got very upset when I moved her food bowl so I could stay close to the telephone.
I met you, Delaney, when your dog was dying. Because we had that, Kate had that Dogs and Dolphins site.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And I was
right.
in that, and that was all about that same time.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And that
name. Yeah, that was, yeah, that's right. I'd forgotten about that.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody consoled you.
Yeah, that was nice.
Everybody suffered that death with you for sure.
Yeah, I know. That was really amazing. Yeah, that, and other people too. It was, you know, I just spouted it out. You know, hey, you know, I'm hurting,
mm-hmm.
and Jala too. And we got a lot of feedback on that. It was very helpful.
Well, we have two people on the line here. I believe we have Sid and Tom. Let me just bring Sid on. Hi, Sid.
Right. Hi, Sid.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been listening to the story. I read that already, and it's interesting hearing you read it, too. So I've been here working on my course calendar for summer term.
Oh, yeah. I couldn't read it, by the way.
Never read, right?
I said I didn't read it.
Oh, you just said it, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah, that's, well, you know, it's in my memory bank, so I
Right, yeah.
I brought
so
it
you
up
can just speak it.
Yeah, well,
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I had to practice it, but
yeah,
yeah.
Well, I'm doing my course calendar on public, as a public speaking class.
Oh.
Wow.
Yeah.
So anyway, it seemed pretty
is it hot
relevant.
Where you all are?
What's that?
Is it hot?
It's sunny and it's warm, and but it's not exactly hot.
It's very
it's
hot
nice.
Here.
Yeah, it's just it's sunny though, and if I were out in the sun, it would be hot, but I'm not. So I'm at the computer inside.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's
so
very
anyway.
Hot here. I mean, it's like breathless. It must
yeah,
be hot.
Yeah,
I don't know.
It's humid, huh?
Oh,
it's
very humid. Yeah, we're getting storms here and there.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Well, humidity hits here very seldom in the summer. We have humid winters.
Yeah. Wow.
It's a real toss-up as far as I'm concerned.
What do you mean?
Well, can you imagine a humid winter? I mean, it's, you know, 35
lots
degrees and 90% humidity. Raining.
Raining.
Yeah, I can imagine that, yeah.
Or looking like it will any minute, you know. So anyway,
yeah.
It gets humid in a different way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do like the warm, dry summers. They're pretty neat.
Yeah, I guess. I kind of like humidity because it's nice at night.
Yeah, I know it, and I do like that too.
Yeah. You can sit out for a long time, all night in fact.
That's cool.
Yeah.
And we have some nights like that, but they're not very often.
Yeah,
so
right.
The nights are pretty cool.
Yeah.
Which makes sleeping in the summer good at night. I mean, you don't have to, you know, sleep in air conditioning.
Right. Well, we don't do that.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway.
But everybody else
I probably wouldn't either, but who knows.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway. Yeah, it's a nice day, though. We finally are having summer. It's rained and rained and rained in May and June.
Yeah. Well, it must be hot where you are, Kate, and especially where you are, Joan.
Oh, it's incredibly hot.
Yeah.
Probably 98 out there. I go out and water my plants in the morning, and that's about it.
Yeah.
House.
Yeah.
So.
Let me bring Tom on to say hi.
Yeah.
Hi there, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, Tom.
Tom.
Hi, Tom.
How are you all?
Good.
Hi, Joan. Hi, Sid.
Yeah, doing great. Thank you, Tom. And you?
Good. And Delaney, I got the other side of your synchronistic event here. There's at least one person I can validate It was much too young for Funky Farm, but swears that she was there all the time.
Who
have you run into that at all? Have you ever run into that?
Yeah, there's a lot of people who claim to be there, but, you know, it's just like your dream, Delaney. It's people claim to be there, and they probably are in spirit, or they still are there. God
but they
knows.
But they couldn't have actually been there?
Right.
Because this particular person was too young.
Who was it? Do I know this person?
Do you remember Carolyn?
Who?
Carolyn Dorr?
I don't think so.
Well, that's why she wasn't there, because you would have remembered her. But she swears on a stack of Bibles. That, I mean, it never came up in conversation where I would refute it, but talking to people over the years, myself not having ever participated, I that was the biggest party that I missed, you know, obviously. It was interesting that she sold this line to a lot of people that she was there, and you know, like I asked Kate about it. I asked who's the guy we see at the coffee shop, Kate, sometimes in the morning.
Oh,
used to go there.
Paul Hoffer. I've run into Paul Hoffer quite a lot. Can you believe that?
Oh my
gosh,
word.
He looks just like he ever did. He is, like, looks absolutely wonderful.
What's he doing now?
He has a family that he just adores, and he's just very happy. And he has his own business. And he and I had a reminiscent talk one day, and it was fun. And he certainly is as much a character as he ever was.
Uh-huh.
I think in this day and age, though, that he would probably, when he sees Kate, he's very open about Funky Farm, but probably 90% of his experience, he probably would hide it very much like a Sinn Féin member would. he's a great member of St. James Church. He does a lot of work there.
That's funny.
He's a good citizen. He really is a good citizen.
Yeah.
Who is this again?
He's an old commune member. He's an old commune member.
Okay, because I know that Fritz talked to me about somebody who goes to St. James Church, and that was Spike.
Spike?
Yeah, we knew Spike.
You mean the Spike that you know?
What's that?
The Spike was your friend.
Yeah.
I
don't know whether, you know, this is the same person. The only thing that sounded familiar was the St. James Church part.
No, it's not the same person.
Okay.
I remember Spike. If it's the same person, I remember Spike.
Okay. This is somebody else. All right.
The Funky Farm.
Yeah, but I think he was around. He's been around the whole time.
Yeah.
I think he's still there from what Fritz said.
Yeah.
That would be a miracle for Spike to be going to St. James and be a... upward member of society, because I just didn't think he would ever be. But then again, I never thought I would be. So.
I have a question for you, Dee.
Yeah.
Your police helicopter. You have written this some time ago. If you were writing it today, would you have the police helicopter land and create a disturbance, or would you still allow it to fly away?
Oh, wow. Who knows? I don't think I'll touch that one.
Go ahead.
I think it's best to think of it as a symbol.
Yes. The broom was quite a symbol. I got this, there's this quote from the Caribbean, like a folk quote from the Caribbean, new broom sweeps clean.
Old
broom know the corners.
There's also a little bit of a phallic symbol in it.
I like the broom symbolism, too. I always have something I'm holding on to, and similar to that. It's always a pen or something.
Yeah, yeah.
To the point that I don't even know if I have it or not. You know, where's my pen? Oh, I have it. Ooh.
Yeah.
So that reminds me of the broom.
Yeah, the broom.
It's a different symbol, I think, but it's similar.
Yeah, I think it also relates to the witch's broom. And so forth. You know, there's all kinds of things you can do with it.
Right, right.
And then, of course, the whole thing, it connects to the feminine. And that becomes obvious in the second part of in the second act.
Yeah.
The whole thing, you know, takes on a greater meaning in the second act when there's a resolution or a kind of, it all leads to the end of the second act, which you'll hear, I guess, in September.
So is this just the first act, what you read?
Yes, that was the first act.
I see.
Yeah.
So there's, I read the whole thing at another time, so I wasn't, you know, I'm not aware of just what part it was, but asking.
So you'll be performing the next act, I believe, on the 22nd of September.
Oh, I see. So this will happen again on the show, on Moon, Moo, and You.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, I see. Next month?
No, next in September,
September.
At the Equinox.
Oh, of course. Yeah, so this only happens four times a year.
Right.
Yep.
Right, right. It's Mary Sheila who's on every month.
Yes.
Yes, she is.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And 2020 is on every month, too, and his wife, Carol, so that's always fun.
Oh, yeah.
See,
so you have a pretty cool schedule, then. You're kind of booked, aren't you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just telling...
Yes, go ahead.
Well, I was just telling Kate earlier, it seems the shows just get better and better and better. Maybe we're growing up a little bit. But it was wonderful. It really was, Delaney.
Thank you.
But just a wonderful hour.
Yeah,
I'm anxious to listen to it and see if it came across as well as I thought it would. As well as
it
hoped it did.
I can promise you it did. It was really good.
It did. The microphone, everything, it really came through. We're having some problems lately with microphones not being loud enough, but this was perfect.
When the day comes and I make my transition, one of the first things I'm going to do is meet your parents.
They'd love to meet
one
you.
One bright bunch of kids.
Well, make our way for us. That would be a good idea.
I will do that. I mean, it really fascinates me. I bet that was some more household, wasn't it?
It was pretty lively,
It was.
It really was. It really was.
Especially as we all got older.
Yeah, like from 10 to 15, along in there.
Yeah, I'd say from around, starting around the late 50s until, for about 10 years there. But then of course, we all ran into the generation gap. Even in our household, there was a generation gap.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that generation gap, I actually met Kitty and Frank before I really knew any of you guys.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, right.
And they bridged the generation gap with me. That was the great book series at the Unitarian Church.
Oh, wow.
Right.
And it was like Jesus. I'm talking to my, I'm actually talking to people who could be my parents.
and will be.
It was like pretty amazing.
Well, that,
yeah, well,
that
cool. That's to hear that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you were talking about adaptations, and I also felt that one thing I didn't pick up before, I love what you're doing. This is more of a narrative, but I really like what you're doing with playing the various characters with some of your writing. But this particular narrative brought up for me how easy it could be adapted into a screenplay, because if you follow the narrative, you're getting you're actually giving us camera shots, you're giving us what's going on inside the helicopter. I'm thinking you could actually write a whole screenplay based on, you could have a flashback to the old Funky Farm.
Mm-hmm.
And you could go to, have the whole episode as you describe it, and then have all these various things going on. And really, it really would adapt itself. It really adapt itself well to a screenplay without much complication, I think.
I kind of thought that too, you know, in fact, when I first wrote it, I had the idea that it could be part real and part animation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, and that's one of the reasons I tried to make it very descriptive.
Mm-hmm.
It would almost see the setting in the words. That's one thing I was trying to accomplish.
Sure.
But we'll see what happens. It's always been well received, and I have an opportunity to perform it again out in a place called Floyd, Virginia, which is way out in the mountains. It's about 4 or 5 hours from here.
Wow.
Where they also have it's a little town it's an artist town, and they have a music festival there that's very popular. Anyway, some friends that we met here in Norfolk have moved out there, and they're trying to get me to come out there and possibly do the Lunar Project. I'm not sure when or if that's going to happen, but that would be probably the next date that I would have for the show.
Mm-hmm.
That is great.
Yeah, and it'd be interesting. It'd be interesting to see some other area.
Well, of course.
Well, now you have
fun. That sounds really fun.
Yeah.
And now you have this audio that you can use again and again.
I'm anxious to hear it too. I feel like the show is growing every time I do it. It seems like it gets more real to me in a way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I want to remind you too that you're telling a story about that time in history.
Yes.
So it has a significance that way too.
Yes.
Like when we're all gone from here, your story tells what it was like.
Yes, right.
Yeah, and it was. I mean, y'all weren't the only ones in a commune in the 60s.
No, that's right.
You weren't?
Right.
You sure?
No, I wasn't. I missed all that by, 5 years. I was married and settled when y'all were off playing, I guess.
I should have been.
But that was probably an advantage, Joan.
In the capital.
Yeah. I was supposed to have been settled, and I was married, but we had a second childhood.
It sounds like it. Sounds like you had a child.
We regressed. We didn't like what we missed by being older, so we regressed.
Well, I do think it's interesting to, like, my kids would be interested in that, know, but that time was
we
talk about that often because it's the generation between me and Kate. It's right in there where, things really went kind of nutsy around the country, and it was a strange time in history for sure.
Yes, it was. It was very unique. And,
the best
today,
music in the world.
Today, said it was the last time a generation was innocent.
Yes.
I
believe
that's
true.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We were the innocents, I think.
It was pre-AIDS.
It was so easy to believe in the goodness of the world at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Even though there was so much trouble, it was so easy to believe that it could all just be transformed somehow. And
that we could fix it.
Yeah, well, or it would happen through us in some way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Very powerful. I think it was the first time young people thought they had any power.
I think it did bring us as a generation to the vision of the possibility of creating your own reality. I don't think the whole creation movement would have been spawned had it not been for what went on then at that time.
Yeah,
that's true.
But then when you look at what's going on in the Gulf, and you look at the wars, and you, You look at the way we're reacting to the governments in South America who are beginning to liberate their people.
Yes.
You wonder how it could have gone so wrong.
Yes.
You know, it's...
We could still be doing things and not having the general population even being aware of it.
I think it's that, yeah. It's a lack of awareness even more than an ill will.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, one thing's for sure is that as time goes on, the more we are dependent on the life force.
Yes.
Yes.
And the less we can do about it.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, in my opinion, I think that what you have here is a lot of apparent darkness, you know, and a lot of we have an idea that the Gulf spill and everything is really ruining the Earth, but in reality, the Earth is very resilient, and
yes.
we cannot underestimate that. And instead of beaming negative energy into the Earth and its incapacity to heal, we need to do the opposite. You know, to really, really know that that the Earth can remedy this thing.
Yeah.
With our help, because we can help it, we can beam the energy of love and healing into the Earth's core where it needs it most.
Yeah.
You guys ever... Go ahead.
No, you go.
Did you ever know that phenomenon on TV where somebody's being interviewed, say, you know, maybe the TV is the station's in New York City and they're interviewing somebody in the Gulf Coast or in Afghanistan, and there's a delay, there's a pause before people answer. I'm actually experiencing that for the first time in my own house, because Kate's like talking upstairs, and about 1001 later, I'm hearing it again. It's like an echo chamber.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, that's why we recommend that you turn down your volume, but... Obviously, when you're in the same house, you can't do that very well.
this is not a criticism. It's just and it makes me feel like it makes me feel more important than I really am.
You mean like you're on TV now.
That's a great. Yeah. You know, this is the first time, of course, I've been on the show. Because I'm always teaching at night, and it's been very uplifting. It was nice getting in touch with the family again and talking to Joan.
Yeah.
It's certainly a great, it spurred some great intercommunication here. That was good.
Yeah, I agree.
Right, really was.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I appreciate it too.
Good.
Well, maybe we should wrap it up.
Almost 15 minutes over your time.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Are we still?
And I got to go mail your book, Delaney.
What?
The post office closes at 5. I've got to go mail your book.
Okay, yeah, let's go.
Yeah.
I'm really anxious to get my hands on that one.
Yeah, well, I've got it in its envelope. It's ready to go. Got my stickers on it. I just have to stick it in the mail.
What is the book? What is the book?
The Book of Ammon.
Yeah, the Book of Ammon.
Good. Very
so
good.
We've got something new coming up, and I've got some airplane credits, and I foresee jumping on one and getting over there when you get that done.
Well, I don't know how long it'll take me. It
doesn't matter.
Yeah, it might not be till next year.
That's all right.
It probably won't be until next year, in fact.
I wait for things.
Huh?
Yeah. I'll be here then.
Yeah, right. So. But I do intend to do it. I think, you know, I have to see if I can make a play out of Ammon Hennessy's life. That's what we're talking about for those.
It'll be cool. Yeah, yeah.
If I can find enough drama and interest in it that would translate into a theater piece, then I think I'm going to do it. And I got into it because we have a Catholic worker chapter here in Norfolk, and. The head of that, and I shouldn't say the head, he wouldn't call himself the head of it, but he's one of the founding members. is often arrested and goes to jail, or at least is you know, threatened with going to jail. He's often in court for civil disobedience, doing stuff like climbing up on top of warplanes at air shows and so forth, and unfurling banners which say, you know, peace banners, and then of course they arrest him and he has to go to court, and I guess they poured blood on the Pentagon steps one time, and he spent a year in jail, or I think maybe it was 6 months, whatever, but for beating on a missile at a nuclear submarine site with a hammer, and you know, stuff like that. And I got to thinking about that, and I thought, you know, I agree with him in his principles, but I don't want to go to jail. So
why not?
Well, I don't really care to do that. So.
Well, there's a lot of reasons why not. Go ahead.
Yeah.
I'm kidding. Kidding.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I agree with him. Yeah. I agree with him 100%. And, of course, Ammon went to jail all the time, many times. But I thought, what could I do that would be, you know, like up my alley?
Yeah, that's right.
And so I thought I could put this man on the stage.
Yeah,
well,
that's great. That's great. We all have to figure out what our alleys are, you know?
Yeah.
Right. Let me just say that James Douglas is going to be on our show in a few weeks. And
I want to hear that,
He would be very interested in that play, so.
Yeah,
cool.
And speaking of James Douglas, you know, Oliver Stone was on Amy Goodman yesterday.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
He just done a movie about Latin America. It's a documentary. And
mm-hmm.
he was on Amy Goodman. You can get it up on the internet. And he and Amy Goodman asked him about the assassination because, of course, he made that film JFK as well.
Right.
And Amy Goodman asked him about that, and he mentioned James Douglas's book.
Once again, he did it again. He probably just sold 10,000 copies in the last 24 hours.
Yeah, he mentioned the book right there, and of course, Democracy Now! Has a far reach too.
Yeah.
Oh, I know.
So James Douglas is not an unknown figure by any means. He's just ignored.
Yeah.
It's the topic.
Yeah.
But Oliver Stone is his greatest promoter.
Yeah, I gather. And of course, Oliver Stone is also pretty much, he's at least he's very knowledgeable about that event.
Yes.
So, for obvious reasons.
Well, James Douglas will be on the 6th of July, and also
that's coming up quick.
Yeah, and also the 4th of August. So he's coming on twice.
So it's 2 weeks from now he'll be on.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I look forward to that.
He's going to be on twice?
Yes,
huh?
You will love him because he's so kind.
Yeah.
That's the thing about him. He is an amazing spirit of kindness. That I think about the assassination, I get all pissed off. But he doesn't, you know, and that's really beautiful.
What other day is it going to be on?
It's like, let me think, the 6th of July and the 4th of August. It's the 4th of Tuesday.
Okay.
If the 4th is a Tuesday, that's the way it works. Here I can look.
Oh,
at
the 4th is not a Tuesday. The 3rd is a Tuesday.
It would be the 3rd then.
Okay.
No, the 4th is a Sunday.
No.
The 4th is a Wednesday.
Tuesday.
No, the 4th of July is a Sunday.
Oh,
no,
yeah.
Okay.
I'm talking about August, though.
Oh.
You're talking about
July.
Okay, so
of August, the it was the 6th of July and the 4th of the 3rd of August, right?
That's it. That's absolutely right. Yep.
Okay. I've got a calendar right here.
Yeah.
After all, I'm working on a calendar, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, this is great that we can all visit like this, too.
It's very cool.
Yeah.
It's not uncommon for people during the solstice to get their other days confused.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Why is that?
Huh?
Why is that?
I think it's the power of the actual solstice.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
See, everything becomes sort of a dream, just like the play.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
There was I got little echoings of Shakespeare, of Edgar Allan Poe, of, you know, just beautiful little interludes, you know, coming through. I really enjoyed that.
Well, thanks. I certainly enjoyed doing it.
And Michelle was there?
Yeah, she's here somewhere. She was taking pictures of me in my kitchen studio here. I'll have to put some up if they're any good.
Oh, yeah, please. Please do.
It was very hot. I was sweating like a pig. I don't know if pigs sweat, but you know what I mean.
They
I'm
probably
always,
don't.
I don't have a webcam. I don't need that.
Anyway.
That's next. Well, we love you all, and I'm going to put on the music for Mother and Child by C.D. Jensen. And we can all sort of gather in some other venue sometime. Probably, hopefully before the 22nd of September.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for doing this, Joan and Kate. That's nice. So talk to you later.
Sure. Good night.
Love you.
Okay, love you all.
Our pleasure.
Love you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Good night.
Good night, Grandpa.